Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We were shocked on Sunday by the death of Oscar-winning actor Philip Seymour Hoffman. Hoffman was widely regarded as the best actor of his generation and appeared mainly in independent films. We'll talk about his legacy today. Also this hour, a close look at Spinning Plates, the new documentary about the owners of three different restaurants. That doc and the Oscar-nominated shorts are just a few of the many independent foreign and documentary films we'll review today with our critics. And our critics today are film professor Cynthia Haynes. Cynthia, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Steve.
KCUR Steve Walker is also here. Stephen.
Hi, I'm good. Glad to be here.
And Bob Butler, the longtime film critic who works at the Kansas City Star, also joins us. You can see his reviews at butlercinemascene.com. Bob, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Let's begin with Philip Seymour Hoffman. What a tragic death, shocked everybody this week. Cynthia Haynes, what's the legacy of this man? Many regarded him as the finest actor of his generation. Was he?
One of the finest actors, but I think the best was yet to come. I think that's one of the major frustrations. I've been a big fan of his for a very long time, and one of my favorites of his performances has to be Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. It came out in 2007. I loved him in Doubt, Capote, and even The Master. And it's my understanding he appeared in over 50 movies over the course of his very short lifetime.
He elevated any movie he was in, but any scene he was in. I watched Doubt and Capote this week after the news of his death and was just kind of shed a tear and got teary-eyed about what a loss this is.
Well, okay, imagine you're a casting director and you get this photo of a guy named Philip Seymour Hoffman. You go, what am I going to cast this schlump in? Who would have thought of him as Capote? For crying out loud.
Gosh.
Physically, he has no resemblance whatsoever, and yet he wins the Oscar for it. And that was the genius of this guy. He wasn't right for any part until he got it, and then he was perfect.
Right, and then you couldn't imagine anyone else in it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly, and he did. He just took over that role and became Truman Capote. I just was amazed by that.
Oh, my gosh, I hadn't seen it for a while, but it's something.
Hey, so how did the news strike you guys? Bob, you follow this stuff for a living. It came out of left field. I mean, these things always do. I get that.
They do. You know, it let me understand, it brought home to me that we really don't know what these people we admire are going through and what they are doing, what their lives are really like. I mean, I felt the same way, of course, when River Phoenix died, a drug overdose in front of the Viper Bar on Sunset Boulevard. And you ask yourself, I've watched this man work. I've loved what he's doing. Who knew that there were these demons lurking around there? And you end up also asking, to what extent did the demons inform his great work? And that's the scary part.
You always wonder that, don't you? You always you can't help but have that cross your
mind. Heath Ledger's the same way. I mean, he was much younger than Hoffman and gave just one incredible chameleonic performance after another. And that hit me like a ton of bricks as well.
Well, what's your theory about that, Bob? This notion of these guys who just absolutely pour themselves into these roles.
There's
Heath Ledger
nothing
as
left.
The Joker being the embodiment
of that.
Yeah,
that too. Right, right. There's nothing left. I think a friend of mine and I were talking about it just this morning, and he said, you know, the more I think about Hoffman's death, I think, and the New York Times said this, there's no one who played unhappiness better than him. Mm-hmm. And my friend said, I think that's because he was one of the most unhappiest, saddest man on the planet.
What, wasn't that the name of one of the films?
It was called Happiness, but it was very ironically
happiness.
Titled.
Right.
Well,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, we don't know. People's demons, they have them.
And he talked about it, though. I mean, throughout his career, he mentioned about being an addict and then apparently recently went into a rehab center but stayed only 10 days. Mm-hmm. So it's...
The New York Times retraced the last 18 hours or so of his life, and it's pretty sad.
Yeah.
Are some men going to be held accountable for selling him the drugs?
They arrested three people in the East Village, but their heroin was not the same that was found in his apartment, but there's, I don't know, some kind of nebulous link.
Do you think producers and directors, Bob, you know, when they see a performer pouring him or herself so completely into a role, I mean, is there sort of any acknowledgement of, hey, once the scene is shot, are you okay? Can you regroup here? I mean, how does the film industry handle that level of commitment, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Two words, Judy Garland.
Okay.
Hmm. A young woman who they drugged to get up in the morning and drugged to put her asleep at night so she could work 18-hour days on the set singing and dancing and making us happy.
Yeah. Well, and it's my understanding also.
That was back in the day, though,
that was
too.
Back in the day, but now it isn't. Now the infirmary at the studio doesn't feed you drugs.
No,
you've got some guy that comes to your trailer. But
your assistant does, or your friend of your publicist or whatever.
Cynthia, right. I cut you off. Yeah.
It's my understanding that he also stayed in character, I think, much like Heath Ledger did.
And Christian Bale.
And you know, you go home to a family, and he had a young family, three young children, and you know, you can't reconnect with the real world if, in fact, that's your decision to stay in the darkness.
And some actors don't work that way. You know, we talk a great deal about Judi Dench on this show, and I was hearing Steve Coogan talk about Philomena, which was very intense. He said 5 minutes before shooting some of these scenes, she'd be doing crosswords and drinking tea and just be like, all right, I'm ready to go.
That's amazing to me. That's always amazing to me.
A different way of working than someone like Hoffman or Ledger or Bale.
There's a great story about Hoffman working with Laurence Olivier on The Marathon Man, and Hoffman was having a terrible time getting into character.
Dustin Hoffman,
Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Finally, Olivier says, dear boy, try acting.
That's right. That's a famous story.
Just wrap your arms around it and
you know,
shut up.
Yeah. It's not that deep.
Okay.
But Hoffman was method and you know, so. Yeah.
What's the clip we have from Philip Seymour Hoffman here? It's from the film Almost Famous.
Yes. He's talking on the phone to a young boy who needs a pep talk.
We are uncool. Now, while women will always be a problem for guys like us, most of the great art in the world is about that very problem. Good-looking people, they got no spine. Their art never lasts. And they get the girls. But we're smarter.
Yeah, I can really see that now.
Because great art is about, you know, guilt and longing and, you know, love disguised as sex and sex disguised as love. Hey, let's face it. You got a big head start.
I'm glad you were home.
I'm always home. I'm uncool.
Me too.
You're doing great. You know? The only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're uncool.
That's the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman from the film Almost Famous. What a loss.
Yep.
Okay. Well, let's move on here to the documentary we want to talk about here today, Spinning Plates. Steve Walker, set this film up for us here.
This film follows three restaurants. One is a little Mexican restaurant in Tucson that's run by a married couple. One is a big family dining kind of breakfast buffet place in Iowa called Bright Box.
That suffered a big fire and everything else.
Yeah, they've
had
a couple fires, actually. Mm-hmm. And then they follow Alinea, which is a very high-class, four-star restaurant in Chicago. And it kind of goes back and forth between the struggles that the various people who work there and that the restaurants have. And I want to get him on here and ask him about the thread that unites these restaurants regardless of their stature.
Yeah, let's go there. Joining us right now is Chef Grant Achatz from Alinea in Chicago. And Chef, what a great pleasure for us to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
No problem. Thank you.
Tell us about the thread, as Steve Walker just asked about, the thread that binds these different restaurants together, very different places, very different parts of the country. What unites people here?
Well, I think there's two commonalities to all three of our situations, our restaurants, and ultimately our personalities as people. And that is, you know, we're in the restaurant industry to make people happy, you know, and it's about hospitality, and it's about making people feel comfortable through, in this case, different ways. So at Alinea, it might be more of a entertainment, I guess, if you will, performance art aspect to the dining experience. And at Bright Box, it's about a community gathering place where, you know, everybody in town at one point during the day will visit this restaurant and socialize with their neighbors and feel comfortable, feel at home, away from home, if you will.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in Tucson, you have, again, a family struggling to do the same thing under less than ideal conditions, but they persevere. And I think that's the other thing that links all three stories together is that perseverance, that determination, and that passion to not let any obstacle, any roadblock get in your way. And if you do come across one, you just hurdle it or go around it.
Yeah.
You know, every one of the stories has an aspect of tragedy. You know, you mentioned the fires at Bride Rocks and the Gabbies didn't quite make it financially for whatever reason. And in my situation, there was the cancer. So, but regardless of those obstacles, all three restaurants just fought really hard for what they believed in.
Well, Grant, you just mentioned the cancer you suffered from, of all things for a chef, Grant, my goodness, a tongue cancer. Where does that stand for you right now?
I'm 8 years out of treatment. So at this point, So once you hit that 5-year mark, everybody takes a big sigh of relief. And, you know, it basically means that in order for me to have a relapse, it would be very rare at this point, they're saying. So
that's great.
You know, at the time, it was very Shakespearean. You know, stage 4 cancer that metastasized into the neck, and everybody was like, "Wow, even if he lives, you know, will he ever be able to taste again?" But I did both, thanks to the help from University of Chicago and their creative team of doctors. So my taste is fully recovered, and I'm upright. So
that's great.
Everything's good here in Chicago. Yeah.
Well, Grant, you used the term performance art in connection with your description of Alinea in Chicago. Some folks might be confused by that. Performance art at a restaurant? What are you talking about?
Well, we make the dining experience, which can last up to about 4 hours long and cover about 25 courses in length.
God.
It's very... you know, it's participatory theater in that we want to engage the emotions like you would be perhaps walking through an art museum or going and seeing a symphony or watching a play. It's also very interactive dining. So we encourage the guests to participate in the experience. We're trying to break boundaries and think beyond a plate, a bowl, a knife, a fork, and a spoon. So we engage them by creating new serviceware that, you know, might have them pick up an item in a special manner and consume it in a certain way. So they're getting the textural components, they're getting the aroma, the intentional aromas that might trigger a memory from their childhood. And
wow.
It really is a multi-sensory encompassing experience.
Well, Grant, you're making me hungry. Cynthia Haynes, one of our critics, has a question for you here.
Hi, Grant.
Okay.
Thanks for being on the show today. How did you make connection with the director, Joseph Levy? How did that come about?
In 2002, it was my first head chef job in Evanston, Illinois, which is the first suburb north of Chicago. I was 27 at the time. And he did another kind of a mini documentary called Into the Fire. And it was similar in scope, but much smaller, where he would come into the restaurant and be that fly on the wall for about a week. And at first I was very hesitant because, you know, we're there to cook and provide for the guests and do our thing on a daily basis. And at that point, I wasn't used to having a cameraman, a mic boom, Joseph, a director running around. You know, it was kind of a little bit intimidating for us to, and a little bit scary to think that a crew of 4 or 5 might come in and disrupt what we do on a daily basis. But the thing with Joseph was he was very sensitive to that, and he was able to capture the spirit and the passion going back to 2002 at Trio, was the name of the restaurant. And so when he approached me about this project, you know, we had a long-standing relationship. I knew he was going to work really hard to expose the important aspects of what we do without being intrusive. And it was brilliantly done. It was great.
We're visiting with Chef Grant Achatz from Alinea in Chicago, the great restaurant. Grant is profiled in the new documentary, Spinning Plates. Steve Walker, you had a question, too.
I do, Grant. As much as I love the documentary, there were times during your narrative, your story, as you're dealing with this cancer, while at the same time striving toward another Michelin star, was so inspirational and so inherently dramatic. So I said to myself, okay, when is Christian Bale going to play this man's life? Mm-hmm. has there been any progress towards that, or has anyone else told you that?
Yeah, we've been in a lot of touch with the folks in Hollywood that want to make it into a feature film. There's been many, many offers on the table. Things move incredibly slowly,
right,
in Hollywood. People don't realize they see new movies popping up all the time, but when you're dealing with life rights and trying to find the right team to, once again, like Joseph did, not color the story in a untrue light. We wanted it to be whatever we did. We were very careful about trying to make it as true to reality as we could. Progress, again, we had 3 or 4 deals on the table with really high-profile studios. Some of them didn't feel right. So we're kind of at that same beginning point. Where
so has Bale's name come
up? Totally open to it. Yeah, we're totally open to it. We spoke to a lot of people. I mean, we literally had meetings with Tom Hanks' team and Ron Howard's team in L.A., and we spoke to Tobin Maguire's team. And so there's been a lot of traction, but nothing's come to fruition yet.
Well, Grant, I want to listen to a clip from this film. Steve, can you set it up for us?
Yeah,
here?
This is Grant. This is you talking about how you work too much while you're fighting your medical problem.
This is from Spinning Plates.
There is so much going on in terms of upside that I'm afraid to turn any of it down. I was talking to Heather last night when I got home at 3 a.m. She says to me, "What are you doing? You almost died. Don't forget, you almost died 3 years ago. People that have stage 4 cancer, they don't sleep 4 hours a night. They sleep 8 because that's what their doctors tell them that they're supposed to do so that the cancer doesn't come back. You're sleeping 4 hours a night. That's ridiculous. You're going to kill yourself again. You know, you have 2 kids. You have me. Like, and I look at her and I can't argue with her. I can't say, no, you're not right, because she is right. But right now, the opportunity is too great. Everything is lining up in a way that I've never seen it line up before. It's either going to help me attain my most wild fantasies, the most prominent life goals that I've ever had, or it's going to kill me.
Hmm. So what's your prognosis today, Grant?
It's very solid. Like I just said,
I meant prognosis in terms of, are you going to live with the job you have, or is it going to consume you?
So far, so good. It's not over yet.
Yeah.
Nothing's really changed in the aspects of ambition. That was filmed a while ago, and it's an interesting snapshot now. Since then, we've opened another restaurant and a cocktail lounge, and we're positioning ourselves to open 2 more within the year.
Wow.
So, I really firmly believe it's just, it's that personality that if I stand still, right now I'm pacing back and forth. I would be an unhappy person.
Yeah.
If I wasn't trying to do something new, and keeping busy. So,
yeah.
And that can be a positive thing and a negative thing, like that clip kind of spelled out. A lot of people are like, okay, take it easy. And I'm just like, well, I can do that, but then I'll just be unhappy. And what good is that?
Yeah. Cynthia Haynes.
I just want to make the comment, Grant, that the film and your story in particular is an inspiration for every restaurateur out there. They've all had tough stories to tell and experiences in getting restaurants off the ground. And also, it's a great film for the general public to appreciate what it takes to get a restaurant running.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You know, Grant, I was going to ask you just quickly before you go here. The film describes you as always pushing the limits when it comes to the food you prepare. So what have you been pushing the limits on this week?
Well, we're I don't know how this will come off, but we're trying to create a dessert based around an orange that we hollow out and fill with an orange foam or frost that at the table is frozen in liquid nitrogen so that it becomes very brittle. The entire orange, the rind and everything is edible. And so at the table, and this is going back to this performance art, one of the chefs would come out, spread several components out on the table surface in which the diner would eat directly off of. There's no plates, ironically. But this orange would be kind of thrown, lobbed up in the air, hits the table, and because it's been frozen in the nitrogen, shatters like a glass hitting the floor.
That's so
and
great.
And the whole thing is edible. So, you know, that's kind of how our minds work.
And do you still change your menu every month, Grant?
Yes, we, okay. Again, just trying to keep it moving, you know, and never being complacent, trying never to have dishes linger because that in itself is kind of impeding progress and impeding creativity.
Well, Chef Grant Achatz from Alinea in Chicago, again, he's featured in the new documentary, Spinning Plates. Grant, what a pleasure to have you. Good luck with your expansion, and we'll be watching closely.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You bet, Grant. So the documentary, Spinning Plates, how is it?
It's very good.
It's very good?
Yeah, and,
it's
you wouldn't think that the three restaurants, one's so modest, one is an institution in a tiny town, and then Alinea, have anything in common, and they really don't until about a quarter, about a third, three quarters of the way through. Where's my wrong with my fractions?
Anyway, you realize, yeah.
You realize, okay, these people have a lot more in common than they do differ.
Yeah.
And so he's a character, and I mean, he looks like Christian Bale, and that's why I saw that actor.
Yeah.
Very entertaining film.
Yeah.
And like I said, it gives you an insight into that industry that we generally don't have.
It's not in the theater yet. But
not yet. It's on Jerry's calendar for the Tivoli, but beginning next Tuesday, it's available on demand or on video. So DVD.
Okay. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with our film critics. We'll turn to a whole bunch of films that are out now, including the live-action shorts that have been nominated for Oscars. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation about literary criticism and how it affects writers, you can find that and the weekend to-do list. Just go to kcur.org. Monday on the program, an archivist gives us a peek at the case files of Leavenworth Penitentiary's mobsters, bootleggers, and murderers. That's Monday on the show. This hour, we're visiting with our art, independent, and foreign film critics, Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. And Rapid Robert, let's move on to the 2014 Oscar-nominated shorts. Let's go to live action first.
Okay, well, first, let's back up just a minute and say that it used to be, in the golden age of Hollywood, when you went to the movies, you got maybe one feature, two features. You got a newsreel. You got short subjects. You got cartoons. It was a whole thing. Now, if you're making short films, and they're a very valid art form, they are the poetry short story version of cinema as opposed to the novelistic feature film. Where do you see those now? Well, about the only way you can is to go to the Tivoli here in Kansas City at this time of year. Every year, they will have three programs, one of the Oscar-nominated live-action shorts, of the animated shorts, and of the documentary shorts. And people who love these love them big time.
Well, if they don't show them in the theaters anymore and you can't see them very easily, why do they still make them?
For festivals, for
Stepping stones,
okay. Good point.
And also because, like I say, they're a valid art form. I have been moved by of these movies in ways that I haven't been by full-length features.
Mm-hmm. Ditto there, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about live-action shorts.
Let's talk about it.
We'll start with the only one of this five nominees in this category that is in English. I believe we have a clip from it, right? This is called The Voorman Problem, and it stars Martin Freeman, better known to all of you out there as Bilbo Baggins and as Watson in the Sherlock TV show, and Tom Hollander, a very popular, and you'll recognize him immediately when you see him, British character actor. Martin Freeman plays a psychiatrist called to a prison to look into an inmate who claims he's God. And the psychiatrist gets a bit more than he expected.
Okay.
Would you mind telling me how long you have believed yourself to be a god?
I may ask you the same question.
I do not believe myself to be a god.
You believe yourself to be a psychiatrist?
Yes, since I began practicing my profession.
I have been a god ever since I began practicing my profession.
I see. And what does your profession involve?
Ongoing maintenance. Chiefly.
Maintenance of what? So you created the universe?
Exactly.
And that's from?
That is from The Vrooman Project. It's kind of like a Twilight Zone episode, basically. Mm. Shot in, and I can't quite figure out why, the most amazing widescreen cinematography I've ever seen for a very claustrophobic story. So go figure. Anyway, my personal favorite of these five is a film called Helium from Denmark. It's a heartbreaker. It's about a custodian, a new custodian at a hospital who befriends a young boy, maybe 7 or 8 years old tops, who has a very serious disease. And early in their relationship, the kid says, "They say I'm going to heaven. It looks like a boring place to me." The custodian starts telling him stories, inventing a world called Helium where ailing children can go to get better. Now, you actually see Helium in computer-generated, you know, fantasy sequences, but it's the real emotions that are going to kill you here. And this, in 20 minutes, this movie asks some really serious questions. For instance, does a custodian in a hospital, not a parent or a doctor, have a right to fill a kid's head with this stuff? Is the concept of helium really that much more ridiculous than a cloudy afterlife filled with harp-strumming angels? And where do you stand on lies if the lies provide hope and get you through the day? That's some heavy stuff to cram into 20 minutes.
No kidding.
Some other ones we've got here.
Yeah.
A French film called Just Before Losing Everything. What it's about is a woman, her teenage daughter, and her young boy who are escaping a abusive husband. But the film doesn't come right out and say that's what it is. It's a mystery that you have to parse out little by little to figure out exactly what this is all about. And by the end, it is the most tension-filled thing. It'll leave you quivering. It's really, really good.
Wow.
Another one, a Spanish film, though it's set in Africa, is called That Wasn't Me. It's about a couple, a Spanish couple, who are in Africa ostensibly to do charity work. In effect, they make a business of kidnapping child soldiers and trying to deprogram them. Only in this instance, they are captured by a warlord. Gets very ugly. There's some major warfare, some major atrocity stuff going on here. It's hard to watch. Extremely effective. And then they wrap it up with something that's really kind of fun, a Finnish movie called Do I Have to Take Care of Everything? And it's about a mother and father, their two kids. They wake up late one Saturday morning realizing they don't have time to prepare for a wedding they're supposed to go to. It's kind of a one-joke movie, but it's a good palate cleanser given some of the heavy stuff we've been through.
So it sounds like a pretty good lineup.
I loved it. Honest to God, I could sit and watch these things all day long.
Live-action shorts from Bob Butler, a big thumbs up. Okay. Cynthia Haynes, let's move over to the animated short film nominees.
These are usually across the board, some of the better of the short films that you're going to see as part of the series. The challenge is, you know, is this entertainment for adults or for children?
Yeah.
Is this a profound narrative or a compelling story or a comedy with a clever punchline? And many of them are. Is it an opportunity to show off digital technology, or is it just a great training ground for filmmakers, which I think it is. I think every aspiring filmmaker ought to see this entire series and learn how to tell a story within, 6, 7 to 30 minutes. And one of my favorites in this.
Well, everyone says writing a short story is more difficult than writing a full-length novel, you know. I see that sometimes. Yeah.
Well, one of my favorites is Room on the Broom, and it's about a genial witch and her cat who are joined on a broom by several friends as they set off on an adventure. It's 26 minutes long. It's basically a storybook come to life because it was adapted from a children's book. I have grandchildren. I remember sitting there and reading stories to them and having them look at pictures. It's as if that storybook comes to life. It is absolutely delightful. It's called Room on the Broom, and I believe we have a clip of it.
Okay.
The witch's half-broomstick flew into a cloud, and the witch heard a roar that was scary and loud.
I am a dragon, as mean as can be. And I'm planning to have witch and chips for my tea.
No!
Cried the witch, flying higher and higher. The dragon flew after her, breathing out fire.
My goodness. Is there a limit on how long these things can be?
What is it, 40 minutes?
I think 40 minutes is tops.
Yeah. So you can go 40. Yeah. Okay.
You know, I'm listening to this and I'm realizing what a great cast of voice actors got here.
That's Simon Pegg.
You got Gillian Anderson, Rob Brydon, Timothy Spall, Sally Hawkins. I mean, you could put together your own Shakespeare festival with these people.
So the theme here is that these shorts, whether it's animated, live action, whatever, these things are really still a focal point of so many filmmakers and of Hollywood then.
Right. Yeah. Another favorite, Feral. It's about a wild boy who's grown up in the woods and is found by a hunter and then returns to civilization. That's beautifully done. A guy who was trained at the Rhode Island School of Design using pencil.
It almost looks like Conte crayon illustrations or something. It's not super linear. It's very fuzzy and gorgeous.
And then Possessions, about a man seeking shelter from a storm in a dilapidated shrine. He encounters a series of household objects inhabited by goblin spirits. 15 minutes long from Japan. It's an homage to the concept of, please forgive me, Suku Kogami. And that's the belief that after 100 years, tools and instruments attain souls, and they trick people.
You know what? This was almost like a tapestry come to life. The kind of graphic design they use here, there's a cross here between anime and something that's Disney classic cel animation. Colors, fabrics are recreated on the screen gorgeously, and things are spinning and sweeping around you.
Wow.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And then Get a Horse. If you've been to the 3D version or been to any version of the Disney film Frozen, it's shown as the cartoon prior to that film. It's about Mickey Mouse and his friends enjoying a wagon ride until Pegleg Pete shows up with plans to ruin their day. It's 6 minutes long, very entertaining.
Okay, that's a great rundown there. Steve Walker, how about the documentary shorts?
Well, let's go through them pretty quickly, and then we'll listen to a clip from the last one I'll talk about. First is Karama Has No Walls. It's shot by a group of peaceful protesters in a square in Yemen who were protesting the government. And
so this is pretty current stuff.
Pretty current, only to they find out that the square has been walled in, and the president's or the government's forces.
Snipers up on the roof.
Are sniping and set it on fire.
And the interesting thing about this is that the photographers were the main targets. So these guys are taking pictures as people around them are getting hit by the bullets meant for the photographers.
It's pretty brutal. The Lady in Number 6 is set in London. It's about a 109-year-old woman who plays the piano still every morning and afternoon and then tells her story. She grew up in Prague. Mahler was a family friend. And at 39, she was taken to Theresienstadt, which was the propaganda camp where the Jews put on plays and concerts and all staged as whenever they had visitors.
Mm-hmm.
And she made it. She's 109, still hanging in
Oldest Holocaust survivor.
Oh,
alive.
That's right. Yeah. Prison Terminal is coming up on HBO. It's about a hospice care at Iowa State Penitentiary. We watch an 82-year-old former World War II soldier come to the end of his life, and he also comes to grips with he's grown up pretty racist, and the men in the hospice in the prison that are tending to him are African American.
And you know what's interesting about this is that this isn't funded by the state; they've got no money for it. So these are life term inmates who have taken it upon themselves to carry, lift, massage, pray with, do whatever for their dying fellow inmates.
Wow. Yeah.
It's a way of fighting humanity that they're never going to find outside of prison.
Such a bleak place.
There's one about an artist, Ra Paulette, who carves ornate shrines and rooms out of sandstone in New Mexico, which is very dangerous to do. He does what he calls creating space through extractions because sandstone is
very porous.
It's
porous.
Pretty jaw-dropping when you see the structures.
Beautiful stuff. Yeah. The last one we'll hear a clip from is called Facing Fear. Let me set it up. A gay teenager is kicked out of his house at 13. He ends up in L.A., where one night he's badly beaten up by a group of Nazi skinheads. Over 30 years later, these two men meet at the Museum of Tolerance in L.A.
Wow.
Coincidentally, of course, and which is the greatest turn of any great documentary.
If someone had written this as a fictional piece, you'd go, oh, give me a break.
Let's listen to them talking about, and the skinhead speaks first.
I told them that I used to hang out at Okie Dogs, for example.
I had a 16-inch mohawk, I believe is what he said to me. And there was a moment where I just took a deep breath. Like, there was just a flash back to the alley and just looking back up at that mohawk.
And he said, oh, yeah, I used to hang out at Okie Dogs, too. And I said, yeah.
I'm like, what do you remember about Okie Dogs? Why did you guys used to hang out there? And he stiffened up.
I stopped hanging out there, as a matter of fact, because one night it got really, really violent, and I just didn't feel comfortable with going back.
And I just looked directly at him, and I said, you know who you're sitting across from, don't you? And he said, I knew it before you did.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. Which, you know, one of the really interesting things about this is that this former skinhead had gone 30 years thinking he had killed this kid.
Right.
So there's a bit of redemption beyond just getting your act together.
But he knew it. He just knew it instinctively that something was happening.
It's about forgiving yourself and others.
Yeah, Cynthia.
If you participate in an office pool or an Oscar contest, this is usually the category where people get tripped up. So do yourself a favor before March 2nd, the Oscars. Go to the Tivoli and see all these wonderful short movies.
The docs are tremendous and are on my three to see this week. Yeah.
Well, we just laid out three different ones here, the animated, the docs, the live action. If you don't have time for all three, you do what?
The docs.
Butler's
animation.
Already...
Docs.
Animation.
And this is odd because usually I don't like the live action that
I don't
much.
Either.
But this time I thought at least three of them were
world class.
Well,
that's interesting.
Class.
Well, we got those divvied up correctly.
you're so helpful to the consumer, a listening public out there.
Well, I
to
mean,
gauge,
you know.
Gauge
we
all
love
this.
Docs.
Yes, I hear you. Okay, how about some films that have already opened? Let's move on to Labor Day, 5 days in the life of a divorcee and her son who've become involved with a dangerous fugitive. His name is Josh Brolin.
Steve, you had Joyce Maynard, who wrote the book,
yes,
on the
did.
Show. And how did she sell this rot?
Well, I think
anyway,
we know where you're coming
that's
from
my
here,
setup.
Dr. Walker.
This is one of the most preposterous films. Kate Winslet and her teenage son are basically kidnapped at a grocery store on a Friday over a long Labor Day weekend. By Monday, they're ready to move to Canada as a family. There are such scenes as Winslet being tied up, being fed chili like she's an infant. There's the great pie scene that apparently that you guys put a link to the recipe on your website. We were going to do it as a joke.
Okay.
And let me just say that I watched the whole thing, and it's very skillfully made, technically.
Mm-hmm. But
it needed to have been even worse to be enjoyable.
Yeah.
Because it's so bad.
This is my question. Jason Reitman made this, the man behind Juno and Up in the Air. What do you suppose was the attraction here?
I don't have a clue. Kate Winslet and Josh Brolin, very talented guys. This teenage kid is quite good. But the pie is not even a metaphor. It's a pie that they make together.
Well, because Joyce makes pies, and she wanted to insert that part of
there goes
who
my
she
notes
is into
the trash.
Okay, it's a send-up of the pottery scene in Ghost. And people have referred to it as food porn. It's supposed to be erotic, and it's laughable, unfortunately.
It's not erotic. And the like I said, the pie is not a metaphor, but yet, spoiler alert, the pie becomes very important to this teenager as he grows up into Tobey Maguire.
Well, I think if you haven't caught Steve Walker's drift, then there's no hope for you whatsoever in your lives to come here. Okay. Let's move on here to The Invisible Woman. This is a story of Charles Dickens' 13-year illicit affair with an 18-year-old aspiring actress.
Now, I was going to review it today, but our policy is if it's not showing in Kansas City, we don't talk about it. I enjoyed it immensely.
It's gone. Yeah, yeah. Play it 2 weeks, I think.
Really.
Good film, though.
Directed by Ralph Fiennes. He plays Charles Dickens. I'm a sucker for those period dramas.
I like them too.
Well, it's an interesting piece of history that most people don't know.
Yeah.
He basically divided his house in half, boarded up the doors. He and his mistress lived on one side. His wife and kids lived on the other.
He boarded up the doors?
Yeah, there's a scene of them nailing them shut.
I didn't know he had like 10 children and had this whole story. And Ralph Fiennes both plays Dickens and directed it.
Yeah.
It's good.
So it's a good film.
It's good. Look for it on DVD whenever it comes
back. Film is The Invisible Woman. Okay, give me shelter. A pregnant teen runs away from home.
I don't have too much to say about this film. Vanessa Hudgens stars in it. I did not recognize her as I was watching the film, and it just dawned on me later into the movie that, in fact, she plays the runaway teen. Rosaria Dawson seems to be coming from another movie. She plays a junkie mom, and it just doesn't meld well. Brendan Fraser is on another planet. He's
her Wall Street dad who works on Wall Street, and yet her mom is this drug addict. I don't know. People's templates are very, I guess.
James Earl Jones is in it. Ann Dowd from Compliance. She plays the director of a shelter for pregnant teens. And basically the story, which was written and directed by Ronald Krauss, provides an option for this girl. And instead of getting an abortion, she's encouraged to go ahead and have this child. And the impact it has in the lives of her family.
So we're seeing examples of films. We know now why they're being released in January and February. These are the dregs of the motion picture industry. Right.
Without disparaging after-school specials or the Christian Broadcasting Network, this is what an after-school special would look like on that network.
Okay.
It's not very interesting.
So no to Gimme Shelter as well. This could turn to some local events. And Bob Butler, what's cooking at the KC Public Library?
Got a lot of good stuff. Our Hollywood's Greatest Year series continues at 1:30 Saturday at the Central Library, The Hunchback of Notre Dame with Charles Laughton, the absolute best adaptation, even better than Lon Chaney's silent version, with an unbelievably gorgeous Maureen O'Hara in her first American movie as the gypsy Esmeralda. And then on Sunday, this is on February 16th, the Movies That Matter continues with An American in Paris, winner of the best Oscar that year, beating things like Streetcar Named Desire and A Place in the Sun. I know, it's the Oscars, go figure. Still a great musical. And then the psychoanalytic film series continues at 1:30 this Sunday, Rear Window, Hitchcock's great, great movie about voyeurism with James Stewart. And then 2 weeks after that, The Birds. Those are both at 1:30 at the Plaza Library. Yeah. Hitchcock is the focus of the psychoanalytic film series, and as you can guess, there's lots to talk about when you talk about Hitchcock and psychosis. And then finally, on February 24th, that's a Monday at 6:30, the Plaza Library will be showing Chasing Ice, a recent documentary about a film crew that went out to find evidence of global warming, and it's got some spectacular stuff in it.
I want to move on to Kevin Wilmot's new film. He's the KU film professor. His next film, Jayhawkers, is coming out. It debuts, opens up this weekend. It features, this is a story about Wilt Chamberlain. It actually begins showing next weekend, Cynthia.
Right, February 14th and 15th, the premiere of this film. I want to mention that KU senior basketball forward Justin Wesley plays the Wilt Chamberlain in this film. It's not just about him. It's about the men who modernized college sports and changed the city of Lawrence during the civil rights movement.
You got to love Kevin. Yes. He's sitting out here in the middle of Kansas, and he puts together these small budget productions that are actually about something.
Yeah. Yes. I saw a little part of the film last night, an excerpt on KCPT's local show. And a great scene with some of the Jayhawk people, the administrative types, putting up little walls so that people can't see Wilt Chamberlain in the restaurant, little screens. So they want to screen him off from the rest of the restaurant, you know, so you don't want to see a black man sitting in the restaurant. It's just an amazing kind
of thing. Well, late 1950s were not a racially friendly place anywhere in this country, really.
And this is going to be at the Lead Center at the KU campus on the 14th and 15th. So check the
website.
Yes, at the Lead Center.
Jayhawkers opens up next weekend, but we're out of time. I want to thank Bob Butler, Cynthia Haynes, and Steve Walker. You guys are always great.
Thanks
for coming in.
Yeah, it's fun.
So good to have you.